Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. Vi Velo Fix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, chase your destiny. By Premium Plus Sports, the official travel partner of the Tough Man Triathlon Series. By USA-SwimRun.com. Really awesome events. Grab a partner and try a swim run event. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We have now raised $95 million, sent out over 23,000 grants to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, one of our favorite people on the planet, six-time Ironman world champion, 10-time Nice champion, won the first ever triathlon world championship in 1989 in Avignon, France. His name, and he's also inductee into USA Triathlon Hall of Fame, Ironman Hall of Fame, Mr. Mark Allen, the Grip. Mark, how you doing, bud?
Wow, that's quite an intro, Bob.
Well, you're quite an athlete. Yeah. You know, also, I think it was Sports Illustrated. Was it Sports Illustrated or fittest man in history? Something like that.
Yeah, it was Outside Magazine. It was actually the year after I retired. They put me on the cover. And
yeah.
Said, world's fittest man. And I still see posts that people put up about that. Like, how can that guy call himself world's fittest man? I go, I never called myself that. Outside Magazine did.
Exactly. That's always a toughie when someone else puts a label like that. Greatest triathlete of all time. And I'm like, he didn't say that.
Boy.
We're saying that. Yeah. That's what we do. We're selling magazines. That's what it's about.
All right.
So we've talked a lot over the years on 89, knocking off Dave, and that classic race where you knocked off the greatest guy in Ironman history up until that point on the greatest day he ever had. Right, he ran a 2:41 marathon off the bike. He went 8:10, 18 minutes faster than he'd ever gone before. You won, sort of exercised that demon, and then your last race in Kona, your sixth championship, when you came from 13 minutes down to run past Thomas Hellriegel, and basically at the age of 37, came across that line knowing that on the last day you ever were going to have racing a triathlon, you had one of the greatest comebacks of all time. But what we haven't talked that much about is sort of those races in between. So after you win and knock off Dave in 89, leading into 90, were you thinking, this, hey, this is going to be a rematch now, and I'm going to be the defending champion?
You know, going into 1990, there was really only one reason that I went back, because after 89, I was just so completely fulfilled and satisfied. I mean, it was a dream just to do an Ironman, and to be able to win the world championship there in the race that we had, Dave and I together. You know, I didn't need anything more, except there was one thing. I thought, was that a fluke?
Right. You know,
was that just like a one-off? And so, you know, 1990, I came back, and there wasn't the rematch. You know, Dave wasn't on the start line, and so it was a whole different ball game. And they had also changed the course a little bit. I think that was the year they added the pit, the energy lab. So there was some new territory, new turf. And ironically, 89 was my closest victory, 58 seconds. And then in 1990, it was a very different race. That was I kind of wasn't challenged for
right.
much of the day. You know, I had a normal swim, 51:43. My bike was 4:43, which back in those days was
really good.
You know, it was respectable.
Yeah.
And then my run 2:52. Scott Tinley was second, but he was about eight and a half, nine minutes behind me. So I never felt the pressure, and it was just kind of like floating through this day. It ended up being the largest margin of victory that I had.
Right. And it was a tough day. I mean, it was one of those days where, you know, Tinley was running through the carnage. He had a 4:51 bike and ran his way through up to second place. And you know how he is. The harder the conditions, the better he's going to do. So, but he was too far back.
Yeah, you know, I just between the swim and my bike was a lot better than his on that day. So
right.
it just that was kind of the margin right there, which was which was very different than things evolved in the years that followed that.
Yeah, because in 91, now you got Welchy, who had been, you know, third to you guys in 89, but way back, 20 minutes back. And going into 91, and you would sort of go through scenarios in your mind, okay, this is the way things might play out. And going into 91, was it apparent early on that Dave was not going to be racing that year as well?
Yeah, he wasn't on my mind. You know, he wasn't really on the radar. And as the race closed in, my spidey sense was saying, you know what, it's Greg Welch. He's going to be the guy who's going to give me the toughest time. And, you know, part of it was because we did some training together, and I could see that he was ready to go up another notch from what he'd done in the past at Ironman. And we actually, a couple months before, went to a half Ironman distance race in Texas. And we swam together, basically swam and bike together, started the run together, but I'd had a hamstring that had locked up on me about a week earlier than that, doing some speed work, and it hadn't quite officially released yet, you know, and so started the run, and just literally like a half mile into it, it locked up again, and I go, I have to pull out. There's no way, because it'll rip.
Right.
And so with Kona coming up, you know, whatever it was, 6 or 8 weeks after that, so literally from that point all the way through Kona, I could run, but I had to run really, really slowly. So I didn't do any speed work on the run in those last month and a half. Every run I did was, you know, minutes per mile slower. So going into the race, I could just see that Greg Welch was really, he was on track. And as it turned out, we were about 45 seconds apart at the end of the swim. I was 51.14. He was 51.02. And then he caught me pretty early on the bike, and we ended up, you know, he outslipped me on the bike. So we basically started the run together. And literally when I came off the bike, I thought, well, I have absolutely no idea if I'm going to be able to take even one step on this marathon, because I hadn't been able to run anything faster than about an 8-minute mile.
Wow.
And, you know, an 8-minute mile isn't going to win you an Ironman, that's for sure.
No.
Not against a guy like Greg Welch, who is literally one of the fastest runners in the sport ever. And so we started out, and, you know, I kind of hobbled the first five, six, seven, eight, 10 steps. And then all of a sudden, I could just feel the hamstring just release. It just like it went poof, like this.
Wow.
And it was the most mind-blowing thing, because it had been tight and locked all the way through. I'd been getting massage on everything, and nothing was really working. And then just in those opening steps of the marathon, it just released. And all of a sudden, my stride opened up, and I thought, okay, game on. But, you know, Welch was so strong, and we went really, really fast through town. But then as we kind of crested out onto the Queen K, I could sense that he was paying the price for the day. It was not an easy day, for sure.
You ended up running like 2:42. He ran 2:48. And now, when you're training with a guy like Welch, obviously you need to train with fast people. At the same time, mm-hmm. on race day, you're gonna have to compete with the guy. So mm-hmm. psychologically, I mean, I'm guessing the last number of weeks leading into the race, you certainly weren't out training with him, because you don't want to give him any confidence. In fact, you can't run faster than 8 minutes a mile. Do you go into that season going, okay, I can train with a Greg Welch at a certain early in the season, but after this point, I can't?
Yeah, there's a, you know, you need the best guys to train with,
right?
Because they're the only ones crazy enough to do the stuff that you're going to do anyway, and they're the only ones that can kind of keep up. However, you know, as you get closer to really dialing in your focus for a race like the Ironman, you really do have to. I, anyway, had to really just hold my energy tight and close to my cuff, you know. And Dave was like that for sure. You know, he didn't have many training partners. He did a lot of it on his own. And so, you know, Greg and I did some stuff earlier in the summer, but as those final weeks came in, no, it was kind of like he was doing his thing, I was doing mine. And again, for me, it was because I knew that he was probably going to be the guy that was going to give me the toughest time, And as you just mentioned, I didn't want him to see me hobbling along on these runs, because that would have been like, you know, self-confidence times 12, right?
And it's interesting. I remember we talked another time about when Jürgen Zach was training in San Diego, and it was a ride early in the season, you know, training ride and probably a Wednesday ride, where he just killed everybody. And you'd be, you know, coming up a hill, and he'd be doing little circles waiting for you to get there, right? He'd be doing little circles waiting to get there. And then later in the season, before he went on Iron Rex, obviously he's thinking, okay, I'm going to kill this guy on a bike. There was a bike ride that you made sure that you did with Jürgen, because you knew you were ready for that ride, and you did the same thing to him where you outclimbed him. So you wanted to put it in the back of his head, listen, you know you can't outrun me. Now you know you can't outride me either.
Yeah, early in the year, I didn't care what happened, because I knew the progression of my fitness and how it was kind of in relation to a guy like Jürgen, who always seemed to be able to get fit really early, really quickly. And I was like a locomotive engine. You know, it took me a while to get up to speed. But once I got going, then I knew that my momentum was going to start really building on the fitness. So that ride that you're talking about, it was about 110-mile ride that we did together right after I came back from my summer in Boulder. I would come back from Boulder, Colorado, 3 weeks before Kona,
right,
train 10 days in San Diego, and then fly over to Hawaii for the last 10 days. And so Jürgen and I had done some training earlier that year, and so when I got back, we decided we were going to do one last long ride together. And you know, I was on fire, and I could just see it. You know, I didn't really go out there with the intention of demoralizing the guy. I was just doing what I knew I needed to do to be ready. And at the point of the ride toward the end, where usually he's like just ready to pull away from me, I pulled away from him, and it was not a big stretch, and I could just see him deflate completely.
Right.
You know, that's why you got to be really careful who you train with very close to the race. If you're training with somebody because, you know, that's how you're going to get your best workout, that's one thing. If you're training with somebody to make a point about your fitness, it's a double-edged sword, because if you can back it up and the other person sees that, wow, this guy really is fit, then it can boost your confidence. If you do the Jürgen and you see that, no, this guy's in better shape than me, it can blow your whole race for you.
Right. Yeah. So basically at that point, he's thinking, okay, maybe I can get second. He's not thinking about winning anymore, because he knows that's over. It's funny, because I remember back in the day when Peter Reed and Tim DeBoom were training together in Boulder. And this was before either of them had won the race. Well, then when Peter wins it in 1998, and Tim's thinking, wait a second, I finished 10th, he won, and I know in my training with him, I've hurt him. There's been a lot of times where he couldn't hang with me, and he won, and I finished 10th? What the hell? Right? That makes it really hard to go and be training buddies after that.
Yeah, I think that was the split in their friendship, that win.
Exactly. And then there was another year where I think in 2000, when Peter won by 2 minutes or something like that, Tim was like, wait a second, I lost the Ironman by 2 minutes? What was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not good, yeah. But you also get motivated by that. So the following year, 92, you said, now you got, again, I think we talked years ago, and you're like, I kept looking at the different, there's Greg Welch, there's Pauly Kirui, there's all these different guys. But you had the sense that there was going to be somebody else. But you didn't quite know who it was until on race day, there's Christian Bustos next to you during a run for a long time.
Yeah, that was at this point, I felt like I kind of had the formula down as far as what I needed to do for my training. But again, you know, winning a race is partly what I do and partly managing what everybody else does. And I went through my mental checklist of everybody that I knew that was there. And then I kind of just went through some scenarios in my mind of, if things don't go my way, how will I deal with them during the race? Because if I can kind of get my strategies in place, you know, maybe something happens on the bike and I come off late or, you know, whatever it is, if I know what I'm going to do before I get out there and it actually happens, then it makes it much easier to go, oh, yeah, okay, I thought about this scenario and this is what I'm going to do. Well, I was doing my pre-race sort of walkthrough in my brain, and I thought there's a scenario that I can't I don't know what I would do if I was in it. And that scenario was that I was running next to somebody who was a faster runner than me. And I, you know, I went through the list, Wolfgang Dietrich, Jürgen Zach, Paul Huddle, you know, just a number of guys that I knew that if we came off the bike together, it wouldn't, I'd probably be able to pull away.
Right.
And so I thought, well, why am I worrying about this? There's nobody here that's faster than me. Well, at the pro athlete press conference 2 days before the race, I walked into the press room, and sitting up on the stage with the name tag was Christian Bustos from Chile. I didn't know he was going to be at the race. I don't know how I didn't know it, but I didn't know that he was racing that year. Backtrack to the very beginning of the year, January of 1992, he and I raced that half Ironman race in Pucón, Chile.
Right.
We came off the bike together. It was a 10-mile run, and he outsplit me on the run by 5 minutes.
Oh, my, you're a 10-miler.
Yeah, and so, you know, my brain's going, oh, my God, 10 miles. He put 5 minutes on me when we came off the bike together and won. Here, if we come off the bike together, you know, he could beat me by 13 minutes. And so I thought, don't worry about it. He's not that good of a swimmer. You know, this is your place. You know, just, you know, get back into your zone. And so race day came. And Christian actually had a pretty darn good swim. He was just about
a minute or so. Yeah.
Yeah. I was 51:27. He was 52:35. So yep. He was just over a minute slower, which was a really good swim for him. And then right away, you know, he was pretty much right up there on the bike. Even though I was telling myself, well, don't worry about it. You know, I got the split that he was a minute back. I go, don't worry. You know, you'll outsplit him on the bike. This is Ironman. This is your place. But, of course, he pulls up next to me on the bike, and then I'm sort of, like, having a harder time holding it together. And then we come off the bike together, and immediately he put 20 seconds on me in the first mile. and then I started to freak out, like, oh, my God, you know, he beat me by 5 minutes and 10 miles in Pucón. He's going to beat me by over 10 here, you know, if it keeps up like this. And it took me almost about 3 miles to actually reel back in that 20 seconds that he put on me. And, you know, at that point in my career, I had a pretty good reputation for being a strong runner. And so if I pulled up next to somebody in Hawaii, you could just sort of see the wheels turning in their brain, like, oh, Mark caught me. He's a better runner. Therefore, he's going to win and I'm not. Well, I pulled up next to Christian, finally, and he looks over at me and I can see his wheels turning. And he was just going, oh, Mark caught me, so I must be going too slow. And he sped up. And, you know, then I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't do it. I was struggling. I could feel my stride tighten. My shoulders were up. I was doing everything wrong. And finally, I just said, just shut up. Be quiet. And it took a while. But finally, I could just feel myself just kind of go, okay. This is the reality. And the second I just had that feeling like everything loosened up, it just became a tiny bit easier to match his pace. And then, you know, we were stride for stride. And then about a mile later, I could start to feel there was a real shift. And I thought, I think I can win it. But I knew I had to be really, really patient. And so we actually ran together through about the half marathon point. And, there was a moment where I could feel like he was really starting to struggle a little bit. So then I surged and he wasn't able to hang on. So, you know, he did end up coming in, I think it was about 7 minutes back from me, which was, you know, about Welch's time was a little bit closer, but the thing that was very different was that I was running with him for much longer. So, you know, Dave and I ran together the entire marathon. For all intents and purposes, Tinley and I were never together on
no,
a marathon.
Nope.
The next year, Greg Welch and I run about 10K together, and then I pull away. Now, with Christian, he and I have run together for almost 13 miles. And so it really felt like, you know, the cushion was getting tighter and tighter and tighter, you know, each year that went on. This was in 1992. You know, amazing athlete. I love Christian. It was really fun to race against him. But it was really pretty intense.
Yeah. Oh, and then one of the guys that I think probably doesn't get enough credit, because if you look at his from 89 to 93, Pauly Kiru was, you know, fifth, third, fourth, third, second. He was always there, right? And so 93 was your year, and I think you caught him in the energy lab. So he was out there a little bit. I mean, you guys were you outswam him, and I think your bike rides were within a minute or so of each other. And then in the run, you caught him and got away. Did you feel in that one that okay, he's not that far ahead? Just sort of let yourself relax and then do your thing.
No, it wasn't like that at all. In fact, it was kind of interesting because 91, 92, 93, each of those 3 years, the guy who ended up second, I basically came off the bike with him, you know. So I was a little faster on the swim. They were a little bit faster on the bike. We came off the bike together. This year, Polly came off the bike with me, and my legs just felt dead and heavy, like they were bloated or like I was, you know, weighed 300 pounds. It wasn't working, you know, and I thought, geez, what is wrong? And he pulled away. He got actually quite a big gap on me. I don't remember the exact amount, but I couldn't really see him. You know, I mean, he was out there, but it was like, oh man. And going into the energy lab, he had a solid cushion, but I thought, okay, I'd actually, things had started to click once I got out onto the lava field, which is fortunate because back then you had about 20 miles out there. And so I really started to pull back some of the time before we got to the energy lab. And when I went in there, I thought, I have to catch him in here. Otherwise, I'm not sure if I will be able to catch him. And going down, back then it was basically a full 2 miles all the way to the very end.
Right.
And I'd made up some time, but he was, when we passed each other, him going the other direction, coming back, he looked pretty darn good. But I thought, okay, there's the long stretch along the ocean and that long uphill. Try to catch him before the uphill, because that uphill was really a place where I felt like I had an advantage because it's super hot with the tailwind.
Yep.
And the heat didn't bother me as much as some of the other guys. So anyway, I finally caught him on the last little stretch along the ocean there. And I have such respect for Polly, and he had put on such a strong race, that when I went by him, I just like placed my hand on his back for just a split second, kind of like saying, hey,
good race.
Great race. I'm probably going to have it though. And literally by just giving him that touch, it's like it woke him up and it gave him energy. And then he stuck with me. And I'm like, no, that was the stupidest thing I've ever done. Why did I do that? You know, you show a moment of compassion against a tough competitor, and, you know, they're going to take advantage of it. And eventually I did pull away, you know, but, so here we are, you know, it's like, you come out of the energy lab, you have about 6
yeah.
miles to go. I caught him at around mile 19. So again, you know, in the end, our times were about 4.5-5 minutes apart. But what the telling part of it was that he was ahead of me for even longer. You know, Welsh 10K, Bustos up to the half marathon. Now Polly's ahead. I didn't catch him until about mile 19. So, you know, that cushion is really shrinking and the momentum is changing into, you know, a lot of other guys who are really threatening for the win.
So in 94, you know, when you sat out, you guys are having your first kid, Matt, who, by the way, is racing Kona this year. Yeah, so anyway, I'll take a step back. So you watched him race in Honu last weekend. How fun was that?
That was great. You know, he unfortunately had kind of tweaked his knee, wrenched his knee a little bit about 10 days before. So he swam and biked fine, but he hobbled through the run. But it was just fun to watch him there and for him to actually race on the Big Island because he's never raced there before. And so he got a real sense of how different the winds are. He goes,
yes.
You know, in Santa Cruz, we have winds, but they're strong and steady. These just go one direction and the other, and they whip around. And he said it's like nowhere else he's ever experienced, which we all know, but it was good for him to see that.
So when you're watching the race, I remember Welchie telling me that in 93, watching the race, he learned a lot from watching it? Obviously, you've won the thing five times already. What did you gain anything from watching that? And especially, you're doing the commentating for NBC, and here's Dave Scott, who hasn't raced in 5 years, and people are thinking, "Oh my God, look at this guy! He's a dinosaur. He's got his, you know, his shifters are down in the down tube. This guy is I think he's got wooden wheels on his bike. This guy, who the hell is this guy? And he's not gonna be fed." I mean, you knew, right? You know, the guy isn't showing up unless he is ready to rock. And were you surprised at all when he rode his way into the lead?
You know, I certainly am the last one who's going to ever discount Dave Scott when he goes on a start line, because I know how strong he is. I know that, as you said, he doesn't show up unless he's ready. And what was interesting for me as a spectator, just in general terms, is that it was the first time that I had actually watched the Ironman, and I could see that a lot of the nervousness at the top folks had, top men, top women, with stuff that was they were really making up in their heads, and it didn't have anything to do with reality. And so that actually helped me the following year when I came back, because I saw that I was just like that. And so when I came back in 95, I was able to just be more relaxed about it. Like, hey, most of the things that I'm nervous about aren't going to happen anyway, so why worry about them? But back to the race with Welsh and Dave Scott, you know, Welsh had pulled away from Dave on the marathon, and we were actually getting splits and following it very closely, because he got a gap, but it wasn't anything giant. And at one point, Dave pulled the gap down to about 12 seconds.
Yep.
And, you know, I was just sweating bullets, because I knew that I know how strong Dave is, you know, and if I had the lead and he had pulled it back to within 12 seconds of me, I probably would have crumbled right then and there on the spot, you know. But Welsh didn't have the same history with Dave, and so there was this classic moment where Welsh looked back, he saw Dave, and saw that Dave was, you know, 12 seconds, and you could just see he's going, "Oh, some friggin' old guy's catching me? I'm going to drop him." And he just sped up like it was no big deal.
Right.
You know, I mean, here's Welsh, he's 29 and Dave's 40. So, you know, he had that brazen kind of perspective on the whole thing. And it was just, it blew my mind, like, oh my God, that would not have happened if it was Dave and I, because I know Dave's history and it would have weighed on me. But Welsh didn't have it. He was free. It's like, some 40-year-old catching me? No way. And just pulled away and went on and won. It was, you know, and it's interesting because Welsh winning that year became the first non-American man to win it. And since then, the only American man to win it has been Tim DeBoon.
I know. It was,
2001,
it was a change, total changing of the guard, right?
It was.
And the nice thing, when you're working with the NBC guys, I'm guessing that you were probably in the interview room while they're talking to these guys. And you can see people who are going to melt under the pressure, right? You're so good at reading people anyways. I'm guessing you're sitting in that room going, he's not going to be a factor. Or Dave is Dave. He's going to be special. And anything you gained from that, from being in that room?
You know, Welsh was, you could tell he was just more focused that year.
Yeah.
You know, he's fun-loving, he's carefree, he goes hard on occasion, he wins a lot of races, but Iron Man had been the one nut that he hadn't been able to crack. And this year, you could just see that he was 94 there. He was willing to just put all that other fun stuff aside and just be down there and be there for business, you know, to get the job done. And it was like a week where he was completely transformed. You know, it was another side to, a very serious side to Greg that he rarely shows. And but it shows what he's capable of when he really focuses.
Yeah, the hard part is he reminded me a lot of ST from the perspective of, you know, ST would do everything, right? He'd go do a sprint race, he'd go do five Ironmans in a year and all sorts of different stuff, right? And Welchie was doing these international triathlon Grand Prix during their summer and then doing Ironman, and he did, you know, basically 20 seasons in 10 years. It was just, he was racing all the time. But in 94, he was like, listen, I'm here on business. He knew he needed that win because he needed to cement his career. He'd done everything else. He'd won world championships. He'd won duathlon championships. He'd won everything except that race. Sort of something you could relate to, because in going in 89, that was sort of the one thing missing from your resume. So also, when I look back at all your Nice races, the one that always sticks out is your, I think it was your 10th, if I'm not mistaken. It was at the 92 race against Cordier, and you were back, I think you were back like, what, 7 minutes off the bike? And it's not like a full marathon, right? It's like 18 miles or something. So you were back, and you weren't gaining that much ground on the guy.
Yeah, the run was 32 kilometers, I think, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I came off the bike 7.5 minutes back, and it's an out and back, so basically kind of like 10 miles, 10 miles. And at the turnaround, I had only pulled back 2.5 minutes, and so I'm thinking, okay, I've got basically 10 miles to go. I've only pulled back 2.5 of 7. That leaves 5. At this pace, if I run like I have in the first half, I will not catch him. And so I thought, well, what can I do? And so I thought, let me run like a runner instead of a triathlete. And so I would just surge like I was doing intervals on the track for as long as I could hold it, and then I'd back off. And then I'd surge again as long as I could hold it, and then I'd back off. And I kept doing that and kept doing it and doing it. And by the time we got pretty much right back on the Promenade des Anglais with about 5K to go, I think I was about 3 minutes down. So I was making up time, but again, it was going to be close. And, you know, for a long time, I couldn't even see the guy. And then finally I could see this entourage of literally hundreds of people in a glob on the street, you know, on mopeds and bikes and just following. And I knew that Eve was up in front of this whole, you know, huge peloton of people who were cheering. But I couldn't see him. And, you know, I had been so far back, and I wasn't making the time up, and everybody was focused on Eve because, you know, the son of Nice, and
sure,
he's in the lead, and it looks like he's going to finally do it. They were so excited. They were so focused on him. And all of a sudden, you know, I closed the gap to the very back of this whole, you know, squadron of folks that were following him. And this one guy turned around, and he saw me, and I thought he was going to have a heart attack, you know, because he's like,
it's his hometown, and he's got a few peloton around him, and so now you're like, when you've got a peloton around you, it's pretty easy to get motivated and start. You're being taken by surprise is very difficult when you're trying to go through a peloton of his fans.
Yeah, and so I kept surging and backing up and surging and backing up. And finally, I could see him kind of up in the distance. But all of a sudden, I could see the finish line banner. And I did one last long one and just surged. And I don't, you know, it was well over a mile. And literally, I passed him just after the two of us passed the 400 meters to go sign on the side of the run course. So literally with, you know, whatever, just over a minute of running left, I made the pass, and I knew that I could not give him any emotional energy because he, you know, you never know. So I just went as hard as I could go past him, and, you know, that was actually the ninth win.
Oh, that was the ninth one. Okay, yeah.
Ninth out of ten. But it was, that was probably, I don't know, it's right up there with the top two or three races as far as most difficult to win that I ever had in my career.
Now, was that the same year that you woke up sick, or was that for the 10th?
The year that I woke up sick was the year that Tinley actually got second.
Okay.
It was in, it was somewhere around...
When you win 10 of them, they sort of all blend.
It was around 86. It was the first, because I won five. I skipped 2 years and I came back and I won five more. And it was in that first set of five. I woke up race morning and I was sick as a dog. I felt like I had the flu. And I thought, well, you know, I flew all the way here. I'll at least do the swim and then I can pull out after the swim. And so I did the swim and I got out of the water and I felt a little bit better. And I thought, well, I'll just start the bike because I can just pull out anytime I want, you know. And I kept kind of feeling better and a little better and a little better. And I came in off the bike and I realized there's only a couple guys ahead of me. And so I thought, well, I'll just start the run and I can drop out if I need to. And next thing I knew, there was one guy ahead of me. It was Scott Tinley. And I thought, I was out there on the run going, this is insane. I woke up this morning feeling like I had the flu, like I couldn't even race, and now I'm in second place in this race. You just never know what's going to happen. And, I ended up passing him, I think, around 3 or 4 miles from the finish. But it was just amazing. Like, you just never know on race morning what's going to happen. You know, you just got to go for it anyway and then just see. You just never know.
I just remember you saying that, you know what, I'm not 100%. Maybe I'm 50%, but I'm going to get 100% out of whatever I am and be happy with the effort. And, you know, rather than going, poor me, I'm sick, and, you know, rather than having the negative vibes come in, everything became a positive, which is something that, you know, that you draw on, right? It's like, oh, my God, I'm in second place, and I wasn't even going to get up this morning. Now I'm, you know, I'm on the podium. This is great. Yeah. Oh, hey, I'm winning the race.
Well, and I in my career, I had a lot of experience at having pretty bad races. So, you know, it's like, hey, if you have a bad race, you know, somehow I'll survive it. It'll be okay. It's not my entire life, but I'm here. I flew all the way across the ocean, you know, all the way across the continents, and let me just go out there and see what I can do. Yeah.
That's so cool.
It was a good lesson for me too, just to reaffirm that.
Like that. And going in to 95, was there a point where you started thinking, okay, I took a whole year off. My body is just not coming back. I'm 37 years old. My body's just not coming back the way it should. Was there a point that summer leading in where you're thinking, I don't even know if I should be racing?
Yeah, even by July, I just didn't know. I felt I'd only had a couple days throughout that year where I felt kind of normal.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe it's age, but I felt like it was more than that. You know, I thought maybe I'm really sick. I mean, geez, maybe I'm dying of cancer. I don't know. And so I had a blood test done just to see if there's anything that the doctors could figure out. And they go, well, you know, your DHEA, you look like you're about 60. Your human growth hormone is almost non-existent. Same with testosterone. I mean, everything that I needed to recover and perform well hormonally was completely down. And I said, well, what can I do? And they go, well, you can supplement all the things. And I go, well, is it legal? And they go, no.
Like, well, but I can't do that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very little. You know,
right.
I mean, I'm not going to throw away my career.
No.
And so that was, you know, where I had Grant Secunda, who I did shamanism with for years. He did a lot of healings on me later, right after that, to really bring my body back around. And it actually ended up being one of the most perfect races I've ever had. You know, there's points where in every other Ironman that I did, I could feel my biomechanics break down on the run. And once they do that, then, you know, your form falls apart a little bit. My feet start slipping in my shoes. I start to get blisters, you know. May not look like it, but I know what's going on. And that year, 95, I didn't have any biomechanical breakdown. I got one tiny little blister. My form was just solid all the way through the very end of the finish line. And it was just amazing because, you know, literally 3 months before that, I just didn't know if I was even going to be able to race.
I remember Michael Rubano, your longtime masseuse, he was telling me, says, you know what, I'd worked on Mark a lot, and I just didn't know if he was going to get there. His body just didn't feel right. But a couple days before the race, all of a sudden, I'm working on him. I was like, oh, my God, he's back. He goes, Mark, this is the Mark I worked on 5 years ago. He's back. He felt it probably before you felt it. He felt it. And then here you are on that, you know, I always talk about classic finishes to people's career. Ted Williams, baseball player, hit a home run in his last at bat. and that type of stuff. John Elway wins a Super Bowl in his last ever football game, and here you are 13 minutes back, that little guy on one shoulder going, listen, my condo is right there. I've won five of these things. I could go camp out. Do I really need this? And then on the other shoulder is like, come on, keep going. And then Greg Welch stops the stretch, and then everything goes positive from there. And like you said, you were 10K with Welchie and 13 miles with Bustos and 19 miles with Pauly Kirui. And now Hellriegel is what, like 23 miles before you caught up?
It was 23. You know, I had 13 and a half minute gap to close coming off the bike, and that was absolutely impossible. Nobody had done that at that point. That's 30 seconds a mile. And so, you know, like you were saying, a few miles into it, I did pass my condo. I saw the driveway, and that, you know, that lesser part of myself was going, you don't need to just go down there. Everybody will understand. And then actually I'd had a long conversation with Brandt before I left for the race. And he said, you know, just remember, it's never over until it's over. Nothing is impossible for, you know, the universe to figure out. So just keep going no matter what happens. Take that next step, and you just never know. And that, all those words came back to me. They're simple, but in that moment where literally I was steps away from just throwing in the towel, saying, I don't need this. I've won five of these things. I feel lousy right now. You know, those simple words just came back, and all of a sudden it's like, yeah, just take that next step. It's not even about winning. It's about crossing the finish line and honoring the race and honoring my career. I knew that was the last Ironman I was going to do. And I thought, I want, no matter what it takes, even if I have to walk every step of this marathon, I am going to get to that finish line. And literally, it was in that instant that Greg Welch, who was about 10 seconds ahead of me in fourth place, stopped. He stretched his back. I passed him. And then it was like the whole world of opportunity began to open back up. But it wasn't easy.
You know,
it took until about mile 23 before I did catch Hellriegel. And that there were 1,000 moments where, you know, it was very hard to just say, okay, yeah, no, keep going even though you can't see him. Keep going even though the gap isn't closing fast enough. Keep going even though you're still just on pace to catch him at the finish line, which is not a good place to catch a guy who's 13 years younger than you when you're sprinting for a world championship, right?
Yeah.
And but it all did work out, and you know, it just shows that, you know, and if you look at the footage, if you watch, you know, some of the Ironman DVDs and you see that race, it looked like I was just kind of in control the whole way. But I always tell people, you know, the greatest victories are the ones that you can't see, and those are the ones where you really do have that, you know, where you have that victory over that part of yourself that has 1,000 reasons why you should have just backed off or given up or thrown in the towel. But to stay quiet and engaged in those moments and just say, hey, I don't care how it turns out. I'm going to just give this next step the best I can, and the one after that, and the one after that, and the one after that. And it did come around.
It's fascinating because, you know, I've been there at the finish when you're, you know, in the medical tent on a stretcher. You're the guy who won the race, right? Your body's quivering. Your feet are blistering. In fact, I was standing at the medical tent, and I've been trying to convince McKeely Jones to do the Ironman. And we're standing at the medical tent when you've got the IVs hooked up. Your feet are coated with blood. Your legs are cramping. And she just looked at me and goes, never, never. This is this guy won the race. He's in the medical tent with an IV. He's not finishing a 4,000th. He's finishing first. I'm never doing this. But then talking to Jan Frodeno 2 years ago, and he looked so in control winning the race. And afterwards, he says, I was planning to drop out I don't know how many different times. This was one of the hardest days I've ever had. So on the outside, none of us can see it. The struggle, right? And that's probably what makes the racing so great is you are overcoming that struggle. You are trying to keep your mind calm and tell it to shut up and just allow you to bring your talents out there.
Yeah, and there's something about doing that I think is really empowering. And I think that's one of the great things that Ironman brings to each of the athletes is that they do have to overcome themselves. And just doing it out there on the race course is sort of like a a life skill that you can use anywhere.
Right.
You just have to remember that you did it.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's, and in the end, it's such an amazing celebration to cross the finish line. And, you know, you've held your emotions at bay all day, and then all of a sudden there's the finish line and all the people cheering, and you know you're going to see your family and friends. And no matter how many blisters you have, no matter how many cramps you had, no matter how many times you thought, I can't do it, all of a sudden you realize, I'm going to do it. There it is. And you cross the line, and it's this. And I think there's something about when you have, you know, that many people so focused and giving everything they have on the same day for the same endeavor, it really sets up an amazing energy for life itself.
Well, and what makes a day so special is we can't go and play the Masters with the top guys. We can't go play Wimbledon. But the Jan Frodeno and Sister Madonna Booter and all the age groupers, the one thing they have in common on the race day is none of them know if they're going to finish. Not one of them really knows for sure if they're going to get from point A to point B and finish the toughest day in sport. And that's what I think makes that thing so darn special.
And you can't buy your way to the finish. You can't.
No.
You can't have somebody do you a favor and get you to the finish. You know, you earn it. And
exactly.
There's something very basic and organic and beautiful about that.
No, I agree. I tell people all the time, it's an equal. Ironman is an equal opportunity abuser. Doesn't care how big you are, how small you are, what your challenge is what your occupation is. None of that matters. It's can you swim, bike, and run 140.6 miles and get there before midnight. Period. End of story. You know.
Well, and we saw that last year with Jan Frodeno. You know, defending champion coming in. The guy knows how to race big races as well as anybody on the planet. And he had problems with his back, a painful pinch. He ends up having to walk a lot of the marathon. Finished in, I don't know, 9 hours,
right.
20, whatever it was. But it's like he said, he goes, it's Ironman.
I couldn't
not finish.
Right.
I had to finish.
Yeah, the event's too important. You know, you have too much respect for that course and for that island, you know, not to get to the finish line. And that's, you know, we've seen it before with Pauly Kirru and with so many different athletes, or yourself, just getting to that finish line on days when you don't have it. And that's, I think that's what helps make it special. So, Grip, as always, such an honor to have you on. Always fun to travel down memory lane a little bit. And obviously you'll be there for the 40th anniversary to capture all of it. It's going to be one heck of a celebration.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people there that maybe I haven't seen for many years just because they're all coming back to celebrate it. And that Ironman packed a lot into 40 years, let me just put it that way.
Absolutely.
Amazing stuff.
Mark Allen, 6-time Ironman World Champion, Ironman Hall of Famer, 10-time Nice Champion, the first champion of the first ever Olympic World Championship was on Avignon, Olympic Distance World Championship in Avignon. And for somebody who had such a big history in France, winning that first World Championship in Avignon at a distance that really you hadn't been focusing on that much in those years, how special was that?
That was amazing. You know, it was the first time that an Olympic distance race had every single one of the best athletes on the planet racing it. And, you know, we had to qualify because it was you represented your country when you were there. So that was something pretty unique and special as well, just to have to go to a qualifying race to secure a slot to actually go to the event. And then just the way the day unfolded, I didn't have a great swim. I didn't have a great bike, but then my run pulled me through. But the part of it that I'll always remember was at the awards ceremony. It was in a big theater, Palais de Pape, and a palace in the palace of the Pope, and it was an outdoor theater. And we were on stage, you know, Glenn Cook and Rick Wells and myself, and you know, they raised the flag and played the national anthem. And you know, I'm kind of a citizen of the world, but that was a pretty proud moment, you know, just to be honored knowing that we had really done something historic. That race, that single race, was the first real stepping stone to getting triathlon into the Olympics, which it did in 2000 in Sydney. And so it was just really cool to win the first ever of something, and to win the first Olympic distance world championship at a distance, as you said, that I hadn't really focused on as much as longer distance races, and to do it in France, where I had so much amazing racing history, and to give part of the speech in French, you know,
yep,
which I think a lot of the folks that were there like, whoa, dude.
Exactly. Exactly. I remember when Greg LeMond learned French, and there's just, it's such a sign of respect for the country when you're up there and you're honoring their language and their customs.
Mm.
Love that.
Yep.
Hey, Grip, one other quickie. We talked before we went live, we talked a little bit about, you know, your winters were spent a lot of time surfing cold water, and you've been one of those guys, you know, who... You raced your season, and then you basically put the bike and the rest of that stuff away and really allowed your body to recover, but also surfing, even in a wetsuit, but in cold water. I'm guessing that really has helped to keep you healthy over the years.
Yeah, I had a very different approach to the off-season than most of my competitors. I took a real off-season from Ironman in October all the way till around January 1st. Anything I did physically was basically active recovery. There was nothing that I did that was specifically to train. So a lot of that active recovery was surfing, which was, you know, it's still moving, you're stretching, you're going in every direction, it's cardiovascular, but it's also very peaceful. You know, it's time in nature. It's not an intense sustained exercise like you get with some bike run. But it was, as you said, I lived in San Diego, so most of the surfing was in colder water. And I think that cold water did really, even though I had a wetsuit, I think it really did help to stimulate my body to recover and to regenerate. And I was doing it in a way that was very fun and low stress and low impact on my body. And the other guys, you know, they would take 2 or 3 weeks easy, and then the next thing you know, they're back at the pool and they're on their bike and they're running again. And, you know, by January 1st, they're already starting to put in some pretty big miles. And it's like, geez, you know, I think it takes much longer than 3 weeks at the end of a long season of hard racing of letting your body really, really absorb sleep, absorb not being as active, let yourself get out of shape to a certain degree. If you're going to then be able to be completely recharged and come back the next year.
Love it. Grip, as always, thank you so much for taking time. And we will, if I don't see you beforehand, we'll see you in Kona.
Thank you, Mr. Babbitt. I look forward to it. It'll be epic.
All right. Again, Mark Allen has been our guest. We are brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series, toughmantri.com, VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. Polar, Chase Your Destiny, Premium Plus Sports, official travel partner of the Tough Man Triathlon Series, USA-swimrun.com, the coolest new event series around. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, last month we sent out 2,806 grants totaling $4.3 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. And Mark Allen was actually there when we first started the San Diego Triathlon Challenge. We're coming up on the 25th anniversary of that. We need to get the Grip back for that. And check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com. Grip, you going to join us?
That sounds amazing. 25 years.
Can you believe that?
You've done a lot of great things for people. That's really amazing.
Well, and it's funny because I remember interviewing you at one of those first San Diego Triathlon Challenge and saying, so Grip, what makes this event special? And you said, it's athletes helping athletes. And that became, mm-hmm. that really became a mantra. It's all about the athletes. How do we keep these athletes in the game? How do we help them avoid that spiraling depression that comes after an injury when you don't know what's next? By getting them in the surf or on a wheelchair basketball chair, whatever it happens to be, you get them back into sport quickly. All of a sudden, they see new doors open, and their life has changed forever. And I'll never forget that. We were standing right there at the Cove, and that interview was something that really made a light bulb go off in my head.
You know, I was communicating with Carlos Molina recently, and he said a comment that I think really summed it up. He said, you know, people just assume that because I'm in a wheelchair that my life is miserable and that I'm suffering. He said, it couldn't be farther from the truth. You know, and here's a guy who won his division at Ironman at, what, age 53 or something?
And five just, times, yeah.
Yeah, just mind-boggling. And, you know, that's what the Challenge Athlete Foundation has enabled people to do, is to just continue on with life and to just go for it.
Yeah, we got to get you back down here. It's a week after Ironman. Maybe we'll see if we can get you to come join us for this one, and that'll be great to have you here.
Sounds super.
All right. Again, check us out on babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.